Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. Well, today we have two interviews for you. First up, we're going to speak with John Wood. He's going to give us some advice on how to raise your kids in the Catholic faith. He is the author of the book, The Light Entrusted to You. And then following that, as promised, we have the talk that Archbishop Charles Chaput gave recently at Villanova. This is really his take on the faith in the modern world. What do we do as Christians in a society that is rapidly or increasingly becoming post-Christian? So we'll bring you those interviews right now. This morning, we're speaking with author John Wood. He's written the book called The Light Entrusted to You. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Barbara. It's great to be on your show.
This book is really important. It teaches, it's called Keeping the Flame Alive, teaching parents how to, or anyone really, how to ignite the Catholic faith in the world. And I just want to ask you, what was your reason for writing the book?
Well, I tell you, as a father and a husband myself, my wife and children were kind of the motivation of the book. It's based on the baptismal vows. That, you know, when our children are baptized, the church reminds us that every child that's baptized is baptized into the light of Christ. And it's our job as parents and godparents and really as a whole parish community to keep the flame of faith alive and keep that candle burning brightly. And so I just really wanted to share with other people the resources that have helped me as an adult layperson learn and fall in love with my faith, and then resources that have helped me pass it on to teenagers at our parish, and resources that have helped me pass it on to my small children as they've grown up. So, you know, we have a wealth of resources in this day and age, and I wanted to, you know, create a book and really a learning system to help other people find those great resources and take that responsibility seriously to be the primary educators and keep the flame of faith alive in our families.
John, tell us a little bit about your background. Were you raised Catholic? What's your story?
Yes, I was. I was raised in a Catholic home. My mom was very devout Catholic. She really was a great inspiration to me in how she lived her faith. My father I lost to cancer a few years back in 2008, and he's also been kind of instrumental in my journey of really embracing my faith and wanting to share it with other people. And so growing up, I always knew what I did was as a Catholic, and my faith was important to me, but it wasn't until I probably went to college and was maybe challenged a little bit more with my friends and relationships and just college life in general, where I really started to ask, why do I do what I do as a Catholic? And so, you know, I just searched for more and more answers, and the more answers I found, the more I fell in love with my faith, and I saw how it was really relevant to everything I did in my life. You know, I was an athlete for much of my youth, and I saw that, you know, that connection of sports and how, you know, Catholicism really was the best way to live. It made me a better athlete. It made me better in my relationships, better in my schooling and my business, everything I wanted to do. I just saw that Catholicism could help me in that. And so it was kind of a slow journey. And then I met my wife, Kristen, and she's been instrumental as well in seeking those truths and seeking the beauty and genius of our faith. And we've raised four kids together. And, you know, the more we fall in love with God, I think the more we fall in love with each other. And so our faith has just been a bedrock of our marriage.
And we should mention that you're a mobile eye doctor from Ohio. How do you go just from having a regular Catholic lifestyle to writing books and being involved in Dynamic Catholic?
Yeah, so I am an eye doctor, and that's my vocation. I actually travel to nursing homes. I'm a mobile eye doctor, so early in my career I discovered I liked working in the nursing homes with the elderly and the handicapped, and that was really a ministry in and of itself. They've really inspired me in many ways, and just in my own parish, I've been challenged by people to start sharing my faith and develop ministries in my own parish, and that's kind of how I got it started, speaking and writing just on the side. And then back in 2010 or 11, I had an opportunity to coordinate a Matthew Kelly event, and he's always been a big influence on me, and I'd been writing this manuscript for my first book over several years, and I just decided to try to give that manuscript to Matthew Kelly, and he took it and read it and published it through the Dynamic Catholic Book Program. And as you know, that's a very popular program. They distribute lots of books, and my book has distributed over 225,000 copies, which just opened up many, many opportunities for me to travel and share my faith across the country. And so I'm really grateful and blessed. I can kind of see God's hand in it all as being a mobile eye doctor that gives me the flexibility to work the days I need to work in my eye doctor vocation, but it also gives me the flexibility to schedule days to travel and speak and do parish missions and events and share my faith with others. So I've been greatly blessed in both aspects of my life, and I think they fit together really well.
And what are the range of the ages of your children?
My oldest child just turned 13, so I now have a teenager, and so 13, 11, 9, and my youngest just turned 6. Her birthday's February 29th, so she doesn't have a birthday very often, but she thinks February 28th and March 1st are her birthday, so she's double celebrating her birthday this year.
Yeah,
so.
She should go see the Pirates of Penzance. That's the whole plot of the theme in that play. Leap year birthday. Anyway, getting back to the book. Again, we're talking to John Wood, The Light Entrusted to You, Keeping the Flame of Faith Alive. You write, to teach the faith, we must know the faith, and we must live the faith, but that does not mean that we have to know everything before we can teach anything. I think that's what stops a lot of people from doing evangelization within their own family, even, is that, who am I to teach? You know, I really don't know that much.
Yeah, so I discovered, you know, as a lay person, that the best way for me to learn the faith was to teach it to other people. You know, those people who challenged me to stand up and give witness talks, to give presentations. I really had to study and learn to be able to give those talks and know what I was saying and listen to other people and learn from their experiences. And so I think we can't let that fear of thinking, I need a theology degree or I need to know everything before I can start teaching. Really, we're on a journey together, especially with our kids. We learn the faith with them. And by sharing the faith and asking questions and looking for answers, that's really how we learn the faith ourselves. So in many ways, I think our children can help us more than we even help them. And so we can't be afraid to start passing on the faith because we don't feel like we know enough. We just have to start and step in, and we're never going to know everything. It's a lifelong journey to continue learning about God and falling in love with God. And that's really what it's about more than anything, is relationships. And as parents, we can be that first introduction to God as Father and God as someone who loves us more than anything. It's not just about rules and regulations to learn. It's about a relationship to build. And so I think parents and grandparents and everybody can kind of relate to that. It's not as intimidating to know that, you know, we're learning with them.
Yes. Well, in your book, you say we need a university, and you have created a Saints in the Making University. You use a lot of acronyms, but the whole point of the book is the word saints.
Yeah, so saints of, I've always been, I love the stories of the saints and the idea that all of us, ordinary people, are called to be saints. You know, my first book is called Ordinary Lives, Extraordinary Mission, that we're all called to go to heaven. Everyone in heaven is a saint, and as parents, our dream for our children should be nothing less than heaven. So we want to make saints, and that's what the church is here for, to help us in our journey to become the saints that we were created to be. And so I structured the book in that way by using an acronym of the word saints. And the catechism, you know, of the Catholic Church structures our faith into four pillars, and I basically just structured it into six pillars that makes up this acronym. So there's six main chapters in the book that I divided up the faith into. I like the acronyms because they help us remember things, they help organize things, and they also help remind us of our mission, our goal, and our purpose is really to make saints, to become the saints God created us to be. So hopefully that acronym is helpful for people in remembering the goal and the mission of the faith.
So this is really meant for any parent to pick up and begin to read about how to start evangelizing. And you say there's six classes. You start with grace and then athletics, instructor's manual. Talk a little bit about these chapters. What is most important in, let's say, saving grace?
Yeah, so my name, John, means God is gracious, and I've always loved the scripture verse from St. Paul that by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace towards me is not in vain. And I think it's important to remember that we can't do all this by ourselves, that we need God's grace in everything we do, and so I wanted to begin with that idea of grace, that grace gives us the ability to live a virtuous life, which makes us, you know, holy, which helps us become saints and overcome our temptations and our struggles. And I think kids need to understand that too, that they're, you know, kids like to be superheroes. They like to, when I say, slay dragons. And so their superpower is grace, that God gives them that grace through the sacraments and through the Holy Spirit that we can, you know, do great things by His grace. And so that kind of leads into a virtuous life, which is, you know, chapter two, I talk about athletics and how sports were a big part of my life and discovering my faith. And sports are really about virtue and that, you know, living that life of virtue through the grace of God. And I think those first two chapters really can be summed up by something my mother always told me. You know, I think the greatest pieces of wisdom I got that I think sums up the genius of Catholicism in one sentence, she said, she always just said, try your best and let God do the rest. And I think that's a good model for all of us as we're growing in holiness and striving for virtue. And so that kind of leads into the story, which, you know, chapter three, the instructor's manual, the eye, is the salvation history, the story of salvation history. Everything in Catholicism assumes we know our story. So I wanted to kind of help people rediscover that greatest story ever told in the instructor's manual to life. And then the most important chapter, I think, is chapter four, which is need to know him. That's the end. And I think, you know, first and foremost, like I was saying earlier, we need to build a relationship with God. We need to fall in love with him. We need to encounter him. He's not an idea or a concept or a fairy tale. He's a real God, a Father who loves us, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and we need to help our kids know God more than anything. And then the T is theology of the body. It's a great teaching from John Paul II about who we are and why we're here and how we're all made in God's image, and so we have to respect the dignity of the body. And then the final S, sacrifice and service, is about the spiritual and corporal works of mercy. And so the church, again, helps us in her genius to become who we were created to be by learning how to give ourselves away to live a life of service and help other people make their day, provide those works of mercy to others. And so I just take those six categories, and throughout the book, it's a learning system. So there's a website that goes with the book, saintsinthemaking.com, and at that website you'll see all the resources that I recommend for each age group and all six of those topics.
Great. It's really very applicable then. Easy to use in your own life and a busy life of a parent. I think, too, the book presupposes that we have an understanding of concupiscence, which I think may not be what everyone understands. The idea, does the church still teach concupiscence, I think has lost a lot of our current parents. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we live in a different world, and the culture and the church can kind of butt heads in some regards. You know, I always say the church, the world says self-indulge in many ways, and the church says, you know, self-discipline. The world can tell us, go out and get what you want. The church will say, give everything you have. The world can say, if it feels good, do it. Church says, pick up your cross and follow Christ. The world might say, you know, love is a feeling, it's an attraction, it's something you feel. Whereas our church, our faith would tell us that love is a choice. You know, just look at the crucifix. It's a choice to love, to do what is best for your beloved. And so I think it's important, especially in the world we live in and the culture around us, that we have to instill this message that not everything you desire is good for you. There's that struggle within. And I wrote about that in my first book. It's the subtitle is The Five Steps to Winning the War Within, that every day we make hundreds of choices, and we choose either the saint inside of us or some second-rate version of ourselves. And that's that struggle of concupiscence. And you know, I think the greatest, you know, one of the greatest gifts we can give our children is to make good choices, teach them how to make good choices in choosing, you know, what Matthew Kelly would say, the best version of yourself or the saint inside of you, over, you know, that concupiscence, that tendency we have to do wrong. We have to understand we have that little battle raging inside of us, and we have to be able to choose to do what is right, regardless of how we feel or what our desires or temptations are. And so, yeah, you're right. I think it's important to teach our kids that in a culture that's kind of taught them maybe something opposite.
Yeah, and I just want to go back too. I mean, I think you point out at the beginning of the book that so many parents don't realize this, but they take a vow before God to bring their children up in the faith. And so in the past, it was thought, we'll just bring them to CCD or take them to a Catholic school, but that's really not good enough.
Yeah, those vows are important, and every time I speak to audiences, I remind them that, you know, if you were married in the Catholic Church, you stood before the altar of God, and the deacon or priest asks you, do you promise to lovingly accept children from God and raise them up according to the law of Christ and His Church? And you said, I do, and when those children were baptized, the church again reminded it, you, that, you know, as parents, it's your job, your duty, your obligation to teach them the faith, to protect them from the enemy, to tell them the story. In many ways, you know, we promised to do that, to be primary educators. And, you know, I think kids thrive on repetition, relationship, and you can't build that by just dropping them off once a week and thinking they're going to get it, especially when the culture is teaching them something opposite. If we're not proactive and we're not passing on the faith, you know, bad things happen, and statistics are showing that in our culture that, you know, through Dynamic Catholics research, 85% of our confirmation students are leaving their Catholic faith within 10 years. I mean, that's just not acceptable, and it has to go back to the deep roots of our faith that can be built in the family and the home. That I think parents are the most powerful people in the world in many regards, because they control the future of, you know, how they raise their children. And you know, children thrive on relationship, and that has to be built in the home through repetition, praying every day, talking to God every day, learning their faith every day as a relationship, and not just a checklist of dropping their kids off. And so I think that's a challenge we need to give parents. I think maybe it goes back to what you said earlier about maybe they're timid, about maybe they don't feel like they can pass on the faith, but we have to step it up a notch in many ways, or we're going to continue losing our children to the culture. And so, you know, a reminder that it is the greatest gift we can give them. It's relevant, you know, and going to Mass, you know, I always tell people the church is a family. It's not a business trying to please customers. It's a family trying to build disciples, and a family that prays together, stays together. And that's why I think sports are a useful analogy, because if they join the basketball team, they know they have to go to practice. They can't just practice their free throws at home. They're part of a team. They have to. It's good to practice at home. It's good to pray at home. But we're part of a team, and we're in this together, and a family that prays together stays together. And we need to come to Mass and, you know, think about it. 1 billion Catholics around the world having the same readings, you know, that's a powerful memo that God can send to the world if we're unified, and the Mass is where we receive Him in the Eucharist. And so just, you know, so much importance there to live the faith and receive the grace of the sacraments. We have, you know, the heart of worship is sacrifice, and the word sacrifice means to make holy. It's sacrifice has always been at the heart of worship, and I think we take the wrong mentality, that consumer mentality, when we go to Mass or programs or services. We think, you know, somebody's supposed to be entertaining us, or you know, feeding us in a certain sense, or giving us, you know, what works for us, and it becomes like a fast food culture where, well, you know, if this doesn't work for me, I'll try this one and I'll try that one. And we've lost that sense of family, of team, of, you know, it's kind of like your mother, you know, when you're growing up as a kid and your mom's birthday comes around and she just asks you to, you know, clean your room, and you're like, well, I don't want to do that. I'll do something different. And you give her something, you know, she doesn't really ask for. But we kind of do that to God. You know, we say, well, I'll become a saint, but I'm going to do it on my own terms and in my own way. And we kind of forget the purpose of worship and what it's all about. And so God knows us better than we know ourselves. He loves us more than we love ourselves, and we have to be obedient and trust to the faith and the practices that He gave us to train us and help us become who we were created to be. You know, God doesn't need us to worship Him. We need to worship Him because it's good for us in that sense. So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
And we have two things at Mass, too. We have the daily, the Word of God, which God asks us not to live by bread alone, but in every word that comes forth from the mouth of God. And we also have the idea of Jesus being totally present, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the sacrament of the Eucharist. So I guess the first question would be, and I know Matthew Kelly is a big fan of this, how important is it for parents? And I know it's quite easy these days to actually get a kid's version of the Mass readings. I know Magnificat Kid puts out something, but for parents to just kind of take the kids through what the readings are going to be and talk about them before you get to Mass, or even if as a parent preparing yourself, you know, sometimes it's chaotic, you're just running out the door and you're distracted, you're not really giving yourself the time to really feed on God's Word.
Yeah, you know, we have to prepare, we have to know the story, you know, and I talked about Instructor's Manual and the Word of God, that everything in Catholicism assumes we know that story. And if we go to Mass and we don't know the story, it's kind of like the same as going to a movie you've never seen before and just kind of showing up in the middle of the movie. You don't know the characters, you don't know the story, you're going to be bored, you're going to be lost, and that's kind of how we do when we show up to Mass. And so when we read the readings ahead of time, when we are ready to listen and understand we know the story and what part of the story we're in, it just makes a world of difference. And so I challenge parents. You know, we have a great program in our diocese, Young Family, massimpact.us, where they create Livit gathering guides to help families gather once a week to discuss the upcoming readings for Sunday Mass. They give them questions to kind of discuss, a really cool video to watch to kind of help you and you know, kind of delve into that gospel reading. And when you do that ahead of time, it just makes so much more difference. The kids are more prepared. They know what it's going to be about. They're ready to listen. They're ready to hear God's voice and what God's going to challenge them in that week to do and apply that gospel to their life. So how we prepare for anything matters, whether it's sports or business or relationships. We got to prepare. We got to work at it. We got to, you know, put our effort into that to make it come alive for us. So I think that is essential for parents and families to talk about those readings ahead of time and understand the nature. Also, you said of the Eucharist. You know, kids ask me all the time, you know, how did you become a state champion? And I tell them, you know, my mom, she used to bring me to Mass every morning before school. And then when I'd go to a track meet or a game, I'd stop in that church and I'd sit in front of that tabernacle and I would beg the God of the universe to give me power to do things that I didn't have the power to do on my own. And he did, not to win an earthly medal, but to win that internal struggle, to try my best, to give everything I have. We receive that grace and that power through the Eucharist, through the sacraments, through the presence of Christ. He's our strength. And so it's just so essential that we go to Mass and receive those sacraments and hear the Word of God and really delve into it.
John, can you speak about those? I know you said your oldest is just beginning to be a teenager, but to speak to those parents who now are experiencing a situation where they have an older adult who's left the faith. I know that is a huge number of people in our listening audience. So yeah. It's never too late. And talk about the importance of the power of prayer, even with your own children. I mean, if you have five kids, some kids will take more naturally to the faith and to a relationship with Jesus. Others may be more scientific and skeptical or be influenced by what they're hearing in their science classes. How does the parent, first of all, navigate through that? And how important is prayer in accompaniment to all the evangelization efforts?
I think we have to remember, you know, that Jesus is the good shepherd, and he goes after lost sheep, and he wants our children more than we want them. He will seek them. He'll never stop searching for them. And the prayers, and I always, you know, I always think of St. Monica and her constant prayers for her son, St. Augustine, and how his life radically changed by years and years and years of her tears and her prayers and her offerings to God to find his son, even when she had wandered away. You know, especially when they're adult children, sometimes it can be heartbreaking. And I talk to brokenhearted parents all over the country. You know, those are usually the people that kind of show up to those events that are open to the public, and they'll come and they feel heartbroken because their son's not there, or their daughter's not there. And you know, I say, you know, it's not about looking backwards or beating ourselves up or what I should have done or what I could have done, but it's about, you know, having that hope and that trust and the mercy of God and the Good Shepherd. And praying, prayers are so, so powerful. You know, St. John Vianney, you know, the devil always appeared to him and actually revealed to him once that he stole 80,000 souls from Satan because of his, you know, sacrifices and prayers, and he never left the little town of ours. And so I think we can't underestimate the power of prayer. You know, I work in nursing homes, and many of those people can't get out. They've lost their independence, but their prayers and their sufferings and offerings to God are so powerful. We can't even fathom how powerful those prayers are. And so we can't lose hope. We can't get discouraged. And most importantly, we have to live that life of joy so that when our kids and anybody we encounter looks at our life, they're going to eventually say, you know, I want what you've got. I can't find anything in the world that satisfies me, because they won't find anything out there in the world that's going to truly satisfy the deepest longing of their hearts. So God, you know, he's always seeking them. And when the time is right, God will bring them back as the Good Shepherd does. And so we have to trust in God and his mercy.
Yeah, and Cardinal Seurat talks a lot about the importance of silence. And we are dealing as parents with kids who are enmeshed in social technology and constant stimulus from their smartphones. The old sense of just trying to sit and get silence and finding God's voice in a life that is so cluttered with social media. It's something different for these kids that are now coming up. So talk a little bit about how, as a parent, to navigate through that.
Yeah, I think we need to be careful in this day and age. You know, it's uncharted territories, the amount of technology out there and what we're going to allow our children to be exposed to. And I think, again, it's a reminder that parents need to be the biggest and best influence on the life of their children. And sometimes that means saying no. Sometimes that means turning off and unplugging. And I challenge parents all the time that, you know, if what your kids are listening to or watching on television or the music lyrics they have or all the noise surrounding them is not helping them become a saint, then at the very best, it's wasting their time. And in a world with so much noise, I think we are robbing our children of innocence in many ways. And I was discussing this with parents, some fathers the other day, and I was saying, I just don't think I'm going to give my children a smartphone. They don't need the internet walking around in their back pocket all the time while they're at home. And they'd say, you know, well, good luck with that. And it kind of made me think, well, am I not the father? Don't I get to make that choice? Like, you know, and if you build that relationship from the beginning, knowing that your kids know your dream for them is nothing less than heaven to become saints, then you can always ask the question, is this going to help us become saints? And I think most teenagers will even admit they wish they could spend less time on social media and internet and their cell phones. They know it, and many people know it. It's just that, you know, we have to have the willpower to say no and to put those things aside and to make time for silence and the beauty of creation and step away from the noisy, busy world. It has its place, but we have to be very careful as parents to make sure we're the primary and best, biggest influence, not the technology and the media and everything that they're listening to.
And as that relates to theology of the body, especially for young women in the age where we have rampant pornography, for a woman to see her self-worth as more than just her body.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, theology of the body is such an essential teaching in this day and age of, you know, helping our kids from very early realize that they are made in the image and likeness of God, that they are precious, that just for who they are, and that they were made to be loved, never, ever to be used. And we live in a culture that really, you know, uses people in many ways. You know, we love things and we use people. We get it backwards. You know, people were made to be loved. Things were made to be used. And with the culture we live in and the TV shows and the music lyrics, they're often talking about lust. They're not talking about love. And the enemy is genius, and he's very subtle. He takes what is good and true and beautiful, and he twists it into a lie. And the difference between lust and love is that love is self-sacrifice for the good of another, whereas lust is the sacrifice of another for our own selfish desires. And there's a subtle difference there, but we've often in our culture with all those messages and the pornography, and we've trained ourselves to use other people and ourselves, and we have to help our kids realize they were never meant to be used or to use another person, only to love, and that love is a self-gift. And it's an important message to get to our kids from day one, because if we don't give them the truth, then the culture is certainly going to give them a lie at this point. And so we have to be proactive in teaching the truth to them about the meaning of their bodies. It's just a very, very, very confused culture, and so we have to fight back. I think the first sin of Adam was not so much what he did, but what he didn't do. He stood there and did nothing while his bride was deceived by the enemy. And in many ways, all it takes for evil to prosper is for good to do nothing.
We're speaking with John R. Wood. He's written the book, The Light Entrusted to You, Keeping the Flame of Faith Alive. It's really a handbook, a little mini university in a book for parents or loved ones of young people, young adults, and even friends and neighbors, how you evangelize your faith and what's important. Thank you so much for your time, John.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And now here's Archbishop Charles Chaput's talk, recently recorded at Villanova University.
The talk is entitled Things to Come, and it's based on an H.G. Wells novel from 1933. Now, some of you who are old might remember that novel. It's called The Shape of Things to Come, and it's about faith, state, and society in our new world. I'm very honored to be the first speaker in this series. I hope that will go on forever and ever. So I don't think my opening line will be surprising, and I think you'll all accept it as true. I say, we live in complicated times. It's easy to be angry and distressed. I know I am much of the time. Earlier this month, a friend sent me an email with a message of exactly 4 syllables. It was, worse is better. He was quoting a famous line from Vladimir Lenin. And his message did have some merit. the worse things get, the more painful they become. The more painful they become, the more urgently we ask why. And when we know the reason why behind our troubles, then we can start to fix them. But there are also two problems with the Lenin quote. First, it's not clear that he ever actually said those words. And second, even if he did say them, they're not true. Parents of the students massacred last week in Florida don't think worse is better. They know what worse means. It's unbearable. Murders in Chicago have been getting worse for many years. They're now so common that the rest of the country sees them as routine. Worse is not better. And one of the tasks of the church, and each of us as individual believers, is to live and work in ways that do help us make the world around us better. What this means and how we do it are questions I hope we can talk about this afternoon. The subtitle of my remarks is Faith, State, and Society in a New World. Each of those categories, faith, state, and society, each of those categories are important. They're all closely connected in thinking about the shape of our country's future. But I want to reverse their order in my presentation. I'll start with some thoughts on society and end with the role of faith, and especially the mission of the church. The reason is simple. There's no healing without a good and accurate diagnosis. If we claim that we need the church as a source of healing and hope, then we need to show what our culture's illness is and why. So let's turn our focus to that work. We'll begin with fact. The United States of America is the most powerful market economy in the world. We can probably agree on that. And most of us would probably agree that since World War II, American democratic capitalism has reshaped much of the world, created a new world of political and economic relationships. We can also agree that Pope Francis's 2015 encyclical, Laudato Si, on care for our common home, is a valuable addition to Catholic teaching. I think that's obvious. It builds on the great talks and writings of Pope Benedict XVI about the environment. It extends the body of Catholic thought on the beauty and stewardship of creation in some very important ways. But one of its vulnerabilities to critics is this. It's seen by a lot of people, who I think are decent and ethical people, as undervaluing the good that global market economies have done worldwide. So let me describe that. Capitalism has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It's radically improved their standard of living. It's increased their opportunities and their lifespans. These are very good things, historically unique things. And those are facts, not propaganda. Unless we acknowledge such facts, unless we voice some real gratitude for the human ingenuity they express, we rob ourselves of the credibility to criticize the damage that market economies have also done. That damage is real and often very serious. It goes well beyond wounding the physical environment, and we don't need to be economists to see how it happens. 70 years ago, the economic historian Carl wrote a book called The Great Transformation. Pugliani showed how the Industrial Revolution disrupted and reorganized the entire fabric of English life. It revolutionized the structure of the British economy. That much was obvious. But in doing so, it also reshaped every other aspect of the nation's culture, from family relations to politics and education, to the use of time, to patterns of thought and behavior. The same thing is happening here in our own country, in our own time and space. A consumer market economy tends to commodify everything and recast all relationships as transactional. In practice, it depersonalizes the culture by commercializing many of our routine human interactions. It also very easily breeds a practical atheism by revolving our lives around the desire and consumption of new things. In our own case, the trigger has been the microchip and everything useful that comes from it. The internet, robotics, and artificial intelligence, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and thousands of other new tools. My point is this: we use our tools, but our tools also use us. They reframe our assumptions, imaginations, and appetites. They rewire our relationships with each other and the world around us. And in the process, every major new technology also creates a new class of winners and a new class of losers. Ask your local blacksmith if you can find one. So where am I going with this? Our country is built on change because we're a nation of immigrants. Change is natural for us. It's also healthy. As long as a nation remains linked in some key organic ways with its past. A nation's identity fractures when it changes so rapidly, so deeply, and in so many ways that the fabric of the culture ruptures in pieces that no longer fit together. I think we're close to that point as a society right now, if not past it. I'll turn 74 in September. In the span of my adult life, the entire landscape of our economy, communications, legal philosophy, science and technology, demography, religious belief, and sexual morality has changed. And not just changed, but changed drastically. Our world is different in kind from the past, and not just in degree. There's no way to unknow what we've learned or experienced, even if we wanted to. And a lot of the changes have been good. For example, medical progress is just an example. Many of my friends have children with disabilities. The lives of their children are longer and richer precisely because of innovations in medical technology. But it's also true that the benefits and deficits of change have been very unequally shared. The result has been a deep dislocation in the American sense of stability, security, common purpose, and self. As a country, we have one of the highest standards of living in history. We also have one of the worst rates of violence and a growing problem with youth suicide. Wealth increasingly congeals in the educated elite. Meanwhile, the gulf between the very rich and everybody else gets deeper and wider annually. The sexual freedom that progressive-minded wealthy people can afford, and which they strongly affirm, is not allowed to interfere with their own pattern of protecting their advantaged position through stable marriages and the best schools for their children. Meanwhile, the lower classes are wrecked by the same sexual license. And unlike the wealthy, they can't buy their way out of the consequences. They're saddled with destroyed marriages, fatherless children, angry and ruthless young males, increased poverty and crime, and all the social crippling results. Philadelphia is one of the premier cities in the most powerful nation on earth, and we still have deep and chronic problems of drugs, unemployment, inadequate schools, and inner city hunger. Hunger in the United States of America. Think about that for a minute. In my experience, this moment in our country's history is the most conflicted and divided since the 1960s. Now, all sorts of bromides are proposed to fix these problems. When our leaders talk about providing a guaranteed family income against poverty, or some form of national income equality, as they sometimes do, depending on the party in power, we can be quite sure that it doesn't mean taking their wealth to give to everybody else, at least not in this country. Effective aristocracies don't work that way. They make other people pay for their ideas. And our merit class, the new aristocracy, that actually provides most of our country's leaders, both progressive and conservative, is very good at masking its own status. Now, I'm not saying anything new here. Christopher Lash, George Parkin Grant, Patrick Deneen, and others have made some of the same points earlier and better. So the question then becomes, if our society is really so stressed, why does everything or anything hold together and work? There are two answers to that. Here's the first. This is a very big country with lots of good people, a lot of good laws, a lot of good talent, and a very deep well of strong character and virtue. It takes a long time to use that up. The more a civil society splinters and fails, the more government will intrude to keep order and fill in the cracks. And that leads us to some thoughts about politics and the state. I'd argue that we now have a Donald Trump, at least in part, because we had a Barack Obama. Mr. Trump is a reaction. He's a gift from the people who felt, or more accurately knew, that they were treated as stupid and irrelevant by both wings of our political leadership class in the last election cycle. In other words, the basket of deplorables, and I know quite a few decent people who were lumped in that basket, showed up to vote. So for better or worse, President Trump is what we now have. And the responsibility for that is both our national parties. Looking back over the past decades, the Obama White House may be the most influential we've had since Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. But Roosevelt dealt mainly with the economic and administrative structure of our country's affair. The Obama White House seemed to go much deeper in seeking to shape the nature of our daily life, ranging from religious liberty to transgendered rights. And these issues, of course, and others like them, are not morally neutral in the light of Catholic belief. In a sense, the Obama administration both reflected recent social data trends and actively encouraged them. Americans who self-identify as atheists, agnostic, or having no religious affiliation at all went from 16% of the population in 2007, not long ago, to 23% in 2014, in a seven-year period. The Obama presidency embodied the same, more secular spirit. That has political and legal implications. Religious liberty is a good example. Religious freedom, as the nation has traditionally understood it, can't be a major concern for people who don't respect the importance of religious faith. If you're not religious, why would you care? And human rights, without a grounding in God or some higher moral order, are really just a matter of public consensus. They're an act of government, largesse, dressed up in pious language about human dignity. The point is, the country we thought we were living in isn't the country we're actually living in now. The administrative state we now have bears little resemblance to the limited republic we had in 1789. Our institutions and our civic vocabulary may seem the same, but the underlying facts of process and power are very different. Most Americans seem oblivious to the change because nostalgia and distraction prevent us from thinking outside the box of our present reality. That should worry us all, because the social welfare state we seem to like and the surveillance state we seem to need more and more overlap. So, where does faith fit into the story? Some 200 years ago, in Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote this, quote, "Fixed ideas of God and human nature are indispensable to the daily practice of men's lives," end of quote. We human beings have a primal need to organize ourselves around someone or something that provides our lives with meaning. We have an instinct to sacralize some form of authority. For America's founding generation, that authority was the God of the Bible, not just any God, as Tocqueville stressed, but the God of Moses and the God of Jesus Christ. Our humility before a just and personal God is the cornerstone of American ideals of limited government, whether we want to admit it or not. For historians like Crane Britton, even the Enlightenment and its deism, which also played a key role in the founding, were children of Christianity. They could only emerge from a pre-existing Christian context. The point is, God's authority ensures human freedom. If our faith in Him is weakened or destroyed as a source of authority, we'll look for another master. In Tocqueville's words, quote, "If faith be absent in a man, then he must serve. And if he seeks to be free, he must believe," end of quote. Life abhors a vacuum. When God leaves the stage, the state inevitably expands to fill his place. Without the biblical God, we end up in some disguised form of idolatry, and it usually involves politics. This is why anything that enfeebles the believing community from within is so hurtful, not just for the church, but also for a culture of true freedom. There are no new paradigms, no new hermeneutical principles, no revolutions in thought, and no possible concordance with the world and its alibis that can erase the radicalism and liberating beauty of Christian anthropology. Key to that anthropology is the nature of our sexuality, expressed in the complementarity of male and female, and ordered to new life and mutual support. Human sexuality, and relationships have a God-given purpose. That purpose is a source of true freedom and joy. It can't be changed or reinterpreted or medically reimagined away. This is the truth about who we are as embodied creatures, no matter what our personal confusion or weaknesses might be. We need to affirm that truth for our own sakes and for the sake of our whole society, because the meaning of our humanity depends on it. And while truth spoken without love and patience can be a weapon, not speaking the truth is a form of theft. Mercy without truth is not mercy. My hope is that great universities like Villanova will always be jealous in protecting their Catholic identity. And not just protecting it, but asserting it. This isn't a time for Catholics to be weak or apologetic. It's not a time to compromise on principles. The witness of faithful Catholic higher education is vital for the whole public square. This is why scholars like Jessica Murdoch, Mary Hirschfeld, Mark Schiffman, and the humanities faculty, Luca Contini, Dr. Sheehan herself, and so many others here are so important, not just for the Villanova community, but for the life of the wider church and the life of our country. Last week, when I was writing these thoughts, I got an email from Charles Gamossi, the Fordham theologian and ethicist. I'd like to quote the whole thing here, because it's very exceptional. But I'll share just this brief part. Dr. Gamossi wrote, quote, "Ours is a deeply fractured and alienated culture. Many people, especially young people, are desperately looking around for something to ground and claim them, a place to discover and express their true identity. How should the church approach such a cultural moment? With confidence and as a huge opening. There is a political realignment underway that gives us a new opportunity to be faithful to our traditions and teachings, apart from the idolatries of the secular left or the secular right. Many young people today are looking for precisely the kind of practiced, ancient, comprehensive version of the good that the church has to offer, one that is not beholden to the political assumptions of their grandparents. They want their house built on solid ground in the midst of a culture that is at sea. The church should enter confidently into this fragmented reality, as we have in past ages, not only with a powerful and attractive message of love, nonviolence, and special concern for the most vulnerable, but with the goal of giving the culturally homeless a place to call home. There are some who in this cultural moment would call us to retreat, to capitulate, to make a dramatic shift in our paradigm. To those, I respectfully say that you are missing the signs of the times. Far from shrinking from our tradition, far from looking for ways to sidestep the ancient teaching and wisdom revealed by God through the apostles and their successors, it's clear that this moment calls for us to embrace the gift of the deposit of faith that has been handed down to us, offering it in humility and love to a culture in desperate need." The end of the quote. I can't improve on that. So I'll end with just a few final thoughts. When you get to be my age in this work, you know and understand a lot of things because you've experienced a lot of things and somewhat developed your skill accordingly over many years. But the same experiences, they give you a little wisdom and mature judgment, can also tend to narrow your ability to recognize new possibilities and solutions. You can end up very good at naming the illness and explaining its nature and cause, and knowing what doesn't work in treating it, but not so good at imagining or bringing about a cure. That diagnostic talent still does have value. People need to wake up to the reality of a problem before they can begin to fix it. But the fixing belongs to a different set of faithful eyes and skills, like yours. We live at a time when science and technology can make the sacramental and supernatural seem implausible. They don't and can't disprove God, but they render people indifferent to Him instead. They make the language of faith incomprehensible. But people still suffer, and everyone dies, all of us. So do the persons we care for. Which means that all of us, sooner or later, ask the question of why. We have an instinctive need for meaning. People still love, which means we have a deep longing for intimacy, completion in the heart of another, and the fertility of new life. And people still have a need for beauty, which means that beauty has the power to invade the machinery of logic and reach right into the human soul. The church, my dear friends, is expert in all of these things. And all of these things prevent human affairs, no matter how confused, from becoming permanently inhuman. Augustine, you know, the patron of the Augustinian community that established this university, would remind us that history is the great destroyer of national illusions and vanities, even the American kind. But history is also the great wellspring of personal and ecclesial hope. We mustn't be captured by the world, but we very much need to love all the good in it, serving the people who inhabit it, and inviting them to the knowledge and love of Jesus Christ. We should never underestimate the power of personal witness, because without a living example of love that people can see and follow, truth is just sterile ideas. What we do as individual believers matters, because our personal witness shapes others. And each of us, as a child of God, is forever. And what we do as communities of Christian friendship matters just as powerfully, because friendship shapes culture and creates the future. This is why things like Communion and Liberation, Focolare, Opus Dei, the Neo-Catechumenal Way, the Christian Life Movement, and similar charisms are so important. They're a source of renewal in the church, which is the sustainer of God's presence in the world. Léon Blois, the great French Catholic convert, liked to say that in the end, the only thing that matters is to be a saint. If we're willing to listen, the church has lots of good reasons why people should believe in God and in Jesus Christ, and in the beauty and urgency of her own mission. But she has only one irrefutable argument for the truth of what she teaches, which is the personal example of her saints. So, this sounds like a bishop, I guess. The task tonight, when each of us leaves here, is to begin that path, to become saints. And if we do, make a big difference. May God guide us all in pursuing this. Thank you for your attention.